Hi, I'm Matt Shepard.
And I'm Chad Shepard.
Coming up on Shep Shower and Shave, the Tigers just wrapped up a series in Boston. I hate the Red Sox and all Boston teams. Who are the teams we love to hate, and who hates us? And Ohio State has themselves a new basketball coach. How much does this late hire in the season hurt other programs, specifically the program in which Chris Holtmann is leaving, Butler? That's coming up next on Shep Shower and Shave. Tigers just wrapped up a three-game weekend set in Boston against the Red Sox. Win, lose, whether you split a four-game series, this is only a three-game series, really doesn't matter to me. It's one of the teams, it's one of the cities, and I like the city in general. I do. I think it's a really, really strong professional sports city. I think it's a gorgeous city. It's we go out there on a regular basis for Cape Cod during the summer, and I love watching Cape Cod baseball. What is it about Boston that makes me – there's two cities, Boston and Chicago, in which I cannot stand their teams. And it has to do with rivalries. It has to do with the Pistons and the Celtics in the 80s, 86, 87, 88. It has to do with the Bulls soon thereafter, 88, 89, 90. It has to do with the Bruins and the Red Wings being an original six showdown on a pretty regular basis, but Boston's really never done anything that has limited Detroit to reach their ultimate goal. The Patriots, it's tough to hate Tom Brady and Bill Belichick from a professional standpoint, but overall, yes, the amount of national love, and I'm not afraid to admit that either, Chad. I think the amount of national love the Red Sox get, where ESPN or any Fox, Major League Baseball Network, always want to put Yankees, Red Sox, it drives me nuts. When I was a kid, I used to hate the Yankees. It used to be the one team I hated more than anything else. Yet I can't stand the Red Sox even more than the Yankees now. Why is that? What teams do you not like? And which cities do you think look back at Detroit and say, I hate them as much as they may hate me?
You know, it's interesting that the discussion going in the realm of an entire city hating another entire city versus one franchise within that sport. You know, because I think about, for example, Tampa. The Red Wings have kind of built a bit of a rivalry with the Lightning over the last couple seasons with some meetings in the playoffs prior to this year where they both missed. But I don't give a crap about the Bucks. I don't care that much about other Tampa teams, but I really dislike the Lightning, and I enjoy disliking the Lightning. Now, there are more deeply rooted dislikes, the most central of which for me is Chicago. I hate all Chicago teams and Chicago sports. The Blackhawks and the Red Wings did battle for years in the when they were in the same division before the NHL you know, adjusted its divisions a couple years back. When they were both in the Western Conference, we had playoff battles. Even in this early, this current Blackhawks era that's so great with Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane, the Red Wings at the onset of those guys' career had some great postseason battles. I believe they had to go through Chicago to get to that 08 Stanley Cup. And then Pittsburgh actually played Chicago, and Boston played Chicago in later Stanley Cup Finals meetings. So I hate the Cubs, and I hate the White Sox. The White Sox are an easy...
Well, wait a minute. What do you hate the Cubs for?
The White Sox are an easy hatred because they have, they're interdivisional with the Tigers. But the Cubs, to me, and it's not just based off of last year's World Series, the Cubs have always had a ton of fans across the nation that are not... To me, not really fans. They like to wear Cubs hats, and that's an easy...
All right, but wait a minute. Don't the Red Wings have the same thing? When they go to Arizona, then they go to Tampa, when they go to Florida, when they go to Dallas, there are more people in Red Wings jerseys than there are for the home jersey.
I guess I have to question if they're wearing those Red Wings jerseys to be fashionable, and I think people... The Cubs are fashionable. I put it like that. The Yankees are fashionable to a certain extent.
It's a chic thing to do. It's not a fandom. It's a chic thing.
If you can't name a player on the team, then I'd have no respect for you. So those Red Wings fans wearing Red Wings jerseys in Arizona, I think they care enough about hockey and like the sport enough where they actually are invested in the team and are excited to see the Wings come to town, as opposed to, I mean, baseball is a more casual fandom sport in general.
So is it more
people that just want to go have a beer and watch a game with some friends that are in town?
Is it more Blackhawks, Red Wings related on why you hate Chicago, or does it go deeper? Because it can't be Bears, Lions for you.
Right.
It can't
be White Sox. I don't hate the Bears as much.
It can't be White Sox, Tigers.
But there's a natural disdain for Chicago teams. There's a proclivity for me to naturally dislike them. You know, if they have a new expansion franchise, I'm not going to like them either.
Right.
And so the dislike for the Bears is less pronounced, but it's present just by a natural rule, I think. And the strongest hate is for the White Sox and for the Blackhawks, for sure.
Which city do you think has that same feeling toward Detroit? Now, the easy answer in some areas might have been Colorado back when the Red Wings and Avs had that fantastic rivalry in the late 90s. But that faded away a little bit. I think it falls back to, I think Chicago has that same hatred. And by the way, I think it's great. I think they have that same hatred for Detroit. And it's obvious when you're playing in the same division like the Lions and Bears do, like the Blackhawks and Red Wings used to, like the White Sox and Tigers currently do, and why the Bulls and Pistons currently do. That's what comes natural. That's what's supposed to happen. And yet, it doesn't get a lot of national play. Why is that? Why is it always the East Coast? We always talk about this, and maybe this is, you know, maybe we're too thin-skinned, too sensitive here. Why is it always the East Coast bias in this regard?
Well, the East Coast bias is a real thing, I think, for sure, in that respect. But in terms of cities that hate Detroit, I'm not trying to pretend that that does not exist, because obviously it does in some shape or form. But
I'm talking strictly from a sports standpoint, Chad. I'm not talking about how the city.
It doesn't seem as pronounced for me. I wonder if Canadians are capable of hating what Toronto really thinks of Detroit, given the sustained success of the Red Wings in a time where, you know, that's their sport and the Leafs are their team.
I think
and
they were jealous.
Long street.
I bet you
right.
They were jealous.
Right. So
there's
does
a
that
difference
jealousy
between jealousy
transform into a
hatred.
Genuine dislike? I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question.
See, I think it's easy for, you know, fans around the country maybe to hate the University of Michigan.
Right. So I think I was actually going to – it's interesting you say that. I was going to talk about Central Ohio because there's such an easy coming together of Ohioans versus Michigans where everyone in state, even if you're a Reds fan, if you're a Reds fan for baseball or a Blue Jackets fan for hockey or something like that, you might be in different parts of the state.
Yeah.
But you'll come together to hate Michigan if you're from Ohio.
Yeah.
And I think Michiganders will come together to hate Ohioans. And that, to me, is perhaps the most easily pronounced dislike of Michigan across the board.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Speaking of Ohio, Ohio State has themselves a new basketball coach. He was hired last Friday. He is Chris Holtman. He's a 45-year-old who was coaching at Butler for the last 3 years. And during each of those three seasons, they won 25 games or more. They advanced to the Sweet 16 last year. He signed an 8-year deal at the age of 45. He's only, I think, 5 years younger than Thad Mata. At the age of 45, he's going to get $3 million per season. I never begrudge somebody for being able to do that. I think that's awesome. He has worked his way up, and he has made himself a lot of money. And based on his credentials, based on what he's been able to do, he deserves it. So the $3 million is, he should be fine fitting in at a more football-oriented school because he's used to that. As a member of the Big East, they went 70-31. He was 6 years at Gardner-Webb, and his career record is well above 500. His teams have won at least 20 games in each of the last 4 years. But I wonder what this, if it does anything. And look, Thad Mata, I don't like him, quite honestly. I mean, he's the only coach. This is selfish reasons. He's the only coach in the Big Ten who did not do opposing radio interviews. I don't like the way he handled himself in certain games against Michigan, what I've seen over his career. But it's hard to deny in the 13 years what he was able to do there. Take nine different Buckeye basketball teams to the NCAA tournament. Send two of them to the Final Four. He won 5 Big Ten championships. He won 4 conference championships. He had a lot of really good numbers on his Buckeye resume. He leaves as the all-time winningest coach in Ohio State history. I don't agree with the way Gene Smith went about this. I mean, if you're going to fire a guy for what he did last year, 17-15, play in the NIT, and not make the NCAA each of the last 2 years, then fire him at the end of that tenure because you're going to have to get somebody. You're not going to promote somebody on your staff. You're going to have to go out and get somebody. Gene Smith knew that. He knew he was not going to promote somebody on his staff. So go out, get somebody. I've brought up numerous players, Mick Cronin, for example, or numerous coaches, Mick Cronin from Cincinnati, Chris Holtman from Butler. That doesn't surprise me at all. However, what is the responsibility of an athletic director in this case to look out for other programs, specifically in this case Butler, who now is left in the lurch in early June to try and find a basketball coach? And remember, Butler doesn't have football. I mean, they got football. It's Division II. But they are a basketball-oriented school. How much of this is at Ohio State? Or do they just have to do what's best for them, do you think?
I do think they do just have to do what's best for them, and it's an unfortunate reality, but it is the status of reality. I mean, at Ohio State, I believe they have in excess of 30 sports. Gene Smith's job is to service those 30-plus coaches. His job is to service those 900-plus or 1,000-plus student-athletes that they have wearing crimson and scarlet. His job is not to worry about the ripple effects of his actions and his school's actions, and that's an unfortunate state of reality, but it is. If he doesn't look out for his and take care of his, nobody else is going to, and in fact, they're probably going to be victims of this. They're probably going to be victims of someone else's pursuits. So is the timing weird? Yes. Is the timing unfortunate for other programs at the Division I level and in the state of Ohio? It's bad for basketball in Ohio, you could make the argument. I don't know. I don't know what kind of moral obligation he has, because in my mind, his job is to fulfill the requests of his coaches and student athletes and make their job of winning Big Ten and national championships as easy as possible. And obviously, I meant the ripple effects will extend beyond Ohio into Indiana and other neighboring states, because as you talked about, there's going to be sort of a butterfly effect where how many steps down the line is this really – how many people is this really adversely affecting? And the answer is a lot more than it looks like at the surface.
Well, look, I agree with you. I mean, that Gene Smith's primary responsibility is not to look out for Butler. It's not to look out for the NCAA landscape. It's to look out for Ohio State University. That's all that should matter to him. The student-athletes on that basketball team, the student-athletes within his campus, and the coaches, as you brought up wisely. That's true. But this is why people have a problem with the NCAA. This is why people have a problem with certain coaches or certain athletic directors throwing this kind of money out. And look, he's got a massive budget. It's like a $170 million budget, right? And he's going to give $3 million of it to his basketball coach. Not a huge deal. I just feel sometimes, this is just my personal feeling, I feel bad for some of these smaller schools that lose these coaches in the first place. It's bound to happen. The Mid-American Conference is a feeder ground for bigger programs. It's okay to lose Urban Meyer to Utah and then Florida and then Ohio State. It's okay to lose Brian Kelly from Central Michigan to Cincinnati to Notre Dame. I applaud the guys who lead those programs. It's how and when you're leaving this program. It is mid-June. And now Butler has to scramble, and they're going to have to find, and this is what they rely on. They're going to have to scramble. They've got to find themselves a new head basketball coach. That ain't going to be easy, man. It's really tough.
No, they're not walking around. They're not a dime a dozen, not at the level that Chris Holtman was doing at Butler.
All right. One of the worst pieces of news we received last week, and you and I didn't really touch on this, and we'll wrap things up with this, was that Taylor Decker has shoulder surgery, and he's going to miss at least into the regular season, according to many reports. So that means Taylor Decker is out when it comes to training camp. It means he's out when it comes to the preseason. Detroit is in a world of hurt now at one of the most important positions. And the key guy that they had signed in the offseason was Rick Wagner at the right side, TJ Lang at the right guard. Taylor Decker, Graham Glasgow on the left side, Travis Swanson in the middle, had the makings of a really good offensive line. How detrimental can this be for the Detroit Lions? We're talking about the left side. We're talking what many people believe to be the most important position on that offensive line, protecting Matt Stafford's back blind side. And a guy, by the way, who he had a really good season last year, only gave up 4 sacks as a rookie. That's pretty impressive. But a guy, by the way, who is expected to make that second jump, it's not as much, am I going to put Cornelius Lucas at left tackle or Joe Dahl, a fifth-round pick out of Washington State a year ago, damn good tackle there in pass protection, but people don't feel like he has the body or the arm length to protect on the tackle position in the NFL. This is not just trying to feed somebody in there. It's the fact that Taylor Decker, when he comes back, how much of a jump can he make on improvement from last year to making an impact as maybe an all-pro player in his second year?
Right. These guys aren't just walking around, not picking off trees, as we talked about earlier. So you can't just walk – you can't just find somebody off the street, especially at this course of the off season. You know, we talked about a couple of the guys that the Lions have brought in for visits. Cyrus Kwanjo, who I don't believe was fully healthy. And they were able to make a signing the other day. That name escapes me right now, excuse me. But to find an in-house solution is not something teams are prepared for. NFL teams aren't structured that, okay, if this guy goes down, if our left tackle goes down, we have a replacement ready to fill in right away.
Yeah.
I think Carolina lost Matt Khalil, who they tried to sign last year,
right,
to an injury.
You were thinking of Tony Hills, I believe.
Yes, yeah, Tony Hills is the guy I was thinking of. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I believe he's collected, you know, he's played in about 19 games or so over the last couple of years for New Orleans. Had a stint before that, but has never
been
a full-time starter
Raiders.
In the NFL.
Yeah, he's been in a ton of different places. This is going to be his 11th team, Chad.
Right.
That's not who you want at your left tackle. Look, if that's the fill-in guy, okay, if that's a guy who is just vying for a spot on this offense because you want to bring in some guys to compete for a position, you know, Corey Robinson, who hasn't been seen at OTAs at all, all right? Joe Dahl, as I mentioned, okay. But what are you going to do with that position if Taylor Decker takes even longer to come back and isn't the same type of player and it's going to take him possibly – you know what people say, the preseason, oh, it's not that big of a deal. Well, guess what? It's a big deal for younger players. They need those reps. Taylor Decker needs those reps. What are they going to do now? They may have to shift some guys around. You'd look at a Laken Tomlinson. What if you were able to make one of those guys a tackle? What if you're pushing Laken Tomlinson in the guard position? Graham Glasgow, did he play tackle at Michigan, by the way, at all? I know he was a center and a guard.
No, he did not play.
Okay,
outside.
So you can't do that. You can't do that with T.J. Lang. Rick Wagner moving him right tackle to left tackle. Your depth is inside. Your depth is Joe Dahl and Laken Tomlinson inside as guards, and Graham Glasgow can shift over to center. The one area on the offense where you lack depth is the offensive tackle position. It's a grave concern for me, and especially after what we're expecting from this team this year, considering what they had to deal with a year ago in running the football or their lack of ability
right.
to run the
and
football.
And here's what we can be thankful for. Thankful for the signings of T.J. Lang and Rick Wagner, assuming they are healthy and ready
absolutely.
To go at the start of the season.
Yeah, right.
Thankful the intelligent pick of Graham Glasgow has panned out, that Travis Swanson has responded to the challenge he was faced with last year mm-hmm. and improved, because those guys have taken steps forward.
Yeah.
And if we were dealing with a line that was – you know, Manny Ramirez and Michael Ola and Cornelius Lucas, this would be even bigger concern for the Lions. So we have to be thankful for that. We have to be thankful that they are already structured in a way to kind of play to circumvent the weakness that could be their offensive line, because Jim Bob Cooter specialized in those quick-release passes for Matt Stafford last year, short drops, getting the ball out of his hand quickly. So they are already structured, and their playbook is structured in a way that can kind of help them step around this for a while. The other thing that could be a big underrated factor, and I believe Pro Football Talk mentioned this, is the signing of Darren Fells that the Lions had over the offseason.
Yeah,
they're
going to
be
big.
A lot of double tight sets, or even beyond that, especially if you have Ebron out there as well, or Michael Roberts out there as well in the red zone. And Fells could be a big factor in helping to keep that edge sealed from a pass protection perspective. Now, how much he'll help on both sides of the ball, he's not going to play every snap. I understand that. But as far as teams being structured to handle this kind of blow, the Lions, they're not in a great spot, but they're not in the worst spot in the world.
I don't know. If you're relying on your tight end to cover up for your tackle, you're going to have a long
it's
season.
It's not any
man.
One of those factors on their own. It's all those things in combination leave the Lions in a position where they're not as hamstrung by this as they would have been a year ago or 2 years ago before Bob Quinn was here, and that's my point.
Still don't like the alternative.